can talk?
We can talk.
We can talk with accents.
Oh, I think that would be marvellous for
you. Yes, it is very fun. But
yes, it is very
good. It's very fun.
Yes. I'm going to press stop on this, Connor.
Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted, everyone. And Gabe,
I was just watching you. You handed me your phone and you made me play that video where a number of people are telling me that they can talk. Real people are telling me, hey, we can talk.
Hey,
I'm looking at these real people yeah. tell me with their human voice that they can talk.
This is an artificially intelligent, an AI video that Gabe was just watching there.
It can't be. It looks so real.
That's what's bizarre. Yeah, and that's the only purpose of playing it for you or playing it on this show is to warn a warning or awareness for everyone out there that there has been a giant leap this week in how realistic AI videos have become. So it used to be the case. There's a famous bad example, and I encourage all of you to look it up at some point. You just go to your favorite search engine and search for Will Smith eating spaghetti. This is one of the first, or it's like the most notorious AI video because it's horrifying. It looks like the US actor Will Smith trying to eat spaghetti, except the spaghetti's wrong, his face is wrong, it's going in the wrong places, everything's awful. And it's a common reference point for, oh, people used to look at it and be like, oh, these videos are...
So as bad as it used to be, now it's that good, is what you're trying to
now
say.
Now it's scary good. Yeah. Now there are videos...
That looked cinematic, actually. Some of those scenes that I just watched where people are telling me that they can talk, that was cinematic. I was watching Quentin Tarantino craft dialogue.
Yes, yes. And what's scary about that is it's a lot of different tools coming together in one.
Except the dialogue sucked.
We can talk. We can talk. We can talk. If you want to try this tool, first of all, you're going to have about $250 a month. It's a Google tool. They unveiled this at their annual kind of tech conference that they hold. It was sort of it was the one that got the most attention. There were a couple things that they showed off, but Flow AI, which is part of the Google Labs, is the tool that combines all of the other AI tools that allow this. Now, some of our most ardent listeners will remember how Gabe, you and I created a fake podcast using a Google tool called Notebook LM.
Yeah.
And it sounded very realistic. It was generating these fake voices. That's one of the tools. And what they've also done is generated not just video with some dialogue, but it syncs it to the mouths and lips.
No, it's them speaking that...
It looks absolutely realistic. In addition to that, there are sound effects that are integrated. There's ambient noise that's integrated. This is 4K. And you need to know that because most people don't. And on whatever social media platforms you tend to use, these videos are going to start popping up without you realizing that they are AI-generated video. We've entered that era really this week.
What's the name of that tool again? FLOW?
Flow AI. Again, it's inaccessible to most of you out there. Just financially, I think they have an introductory rate of $125, and then it moves up monthly. Then it moves up to $250. Mm-hmm. It's going to be worth that money for people. I saw one example in one of the forums I check out on AI, and the guy was saying, look, I created an ad. I work for a pharmaceutical company, I think it was. I created an ad for $500, basically.
Without having to film anything or go anywhere.
Right. And you're going to see these probably in traditional media as well, on TV, in between, you know, a sports event, or especially maybe local ads for local plumbers or electricians or things like that. They're coming, and be aware of that. And also... remain cynical or skeptical. If you see a video that looks too beautiful, too perfect, ask yourself, is this AI? It's as simple, once you've signed up for the tool, one of the prompts that what Google showed off, I suppose, it's just text. That's all you're putting in there. And they went in and the text prompt was backseat of a 1970s taxi with worn zebra print cloth. So like the upholstery on the seat that you'd be sitting on, kind of like zebra stripes, with jellyfish underwater. And I was reading this text like, what is this? Mm-hmm. What came out is a sunken taxi with a zebra print and these beautiful, hypnotizing jellyfish moving before your eyes. That's how quickly and how easily you can generate this stuff now. And as they always say with AI, it's just going to get better from here. This is the worst now that it's ever going to be in the future.
Boy, that's a different take on the dystopian reality of Taxi Driver. Oh. Martin Scorsese had something else in mind. Than that.
No, this is beautiful. This looked like art, but it was created with software and computers somewhere. Last thing I'll say, it's a reminder to everyone to support any company that publicly announces its intent to label AI content. One example I can happily give, is Facebook Meta. Back in July of 2024, they said they will be adding quote-unquote AI info to a wider range of video, audio, and image content. So they're behind that. And then also to, even if it's just vaguely, support the idea of legislation that
I was going to say, maybe this is something that should be forced politically.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is there, but I know that, for example, the EU, we talked about on the show, it was the AI Act originally published back in 2023. And they've forced, for example, ChatGPT, based out of San Francisco, to disclose which content is being made by them to design models to prevent illegal content being generated. So anything that'd be a danger to society, probably pornographic materials that would harm individuals, et cetera, that's not in the model. And then also to publish summaries of copyrighted data used for training. So where are they sourcing that information? This stuff is happening very, very fast, and it's good for governments to be ahead of that curve to the extent that they can be.
I want to say thank you to all the people who wrote to us, and this time really
to you,
to me, with regard to smoking and sharing your stories, how so many of you got over it. There, two I just want to mention right here. David was a teacher and thought that smoking would help him get over the nerves or the stress of teaching. And when he would quit, he would always tell his colleagues, "No, I'm just resting. I'm just taking a break," because he knew that it would come back during the tough, stressful times during teaching that he thought he would need it. And then he went for a committee meeting where they had to spend two nights in an unheated cabin. And all the colleagues that he was with in his cabin didn't smoke. So he knew that there's no way he was going to be able to smoke during this possibly stressful time in this cabin, and had spent two nights contemplating, thinking about his own smoking. And I think the stress for him was not being able to sleep because it was unheated. He knew that because it was so cold, he wasn't going to be sleeping. He was going to probably go 48 hours without sleep. And that he deep down thought that he needed a cigarette to get through this 48 hours.
What kind of conference is this that they put you in an unheated
David,
sleeping
let us know.
Arrangement, David?
What? Who are you working for? School would do that?
They should give you a heater. Really? Or at least, yeah, or allow you to sleep in a heated way.
And then there was Carolyn, who wrote how over time, over a long period of time, years, how she weaned herself off from tobacco all the way down to a little bit of nicotine gum. And that by the end of it, it worked. She got off of cigarettes using nicotine gum. Congratulations, Carolyn. Maybe that's in my future at some point. I haven't started in earnest yet, but I will, based possibly on all the responses that you guys sent to me. That means a lot to me.
That, yeah.
Really, it does.
You were just talking about a sleeping arrangement for David in that case, and I believe it connects to your study.
This is really quick. From Auburn University, they were looking at 286 individuals, all heterosexual, and it had to do with how close you sleep to your partner. And what are my perceived stress levels? What is my attachment insecurity level?
So the fear I'm going to lose them.
And how well am I sleeping? Exactly. Can I trust my partner? And how am I sleeping? So sleep disturbance, attachment insecurity, and perceived stress. The closer you slept to your partner, and the closest of all people were saying that they slept intertwined. I didn't even know what that was. Spooning.
Spooning, yeah.
Spooning and face-to-face.
Wait.
Yeah.
No, face to face, all that CO2. Yeah. I hate that. You can't breathe well because you're breathing their CO2.
Let it be, Connor. The closer you slept to your partner, the lower perceived stress, the lower attachment insecurity levels. So the more that you trust your partner, and sleep disturbance didn't matter. So, but let me just, the important thing here is this was at the onset of sleep. So at the beginning of sleep, it didn't matter where you were sleeping the whole night, just as you fell asleep.
Right. Well, you end up moving away at some point. It gets too hot.
Yeah. I don't sleep with my wife at all. We sleep separate. I think that should be normalized and should be okay. I tell a lot of people that and they're like, what? I think it should be normal. We both snore and I can't sleep at all. Okay. So if I'm snoring, she's going to wake me up. If she's snoring, I can't fall asleep to begin with.
Right. And that is relevant because I believe this is a classic case of correlation and not causation.
Absolutely. Co-sectional. So
it's not like, I don't trust my partner that much. Let me sleep closer to them. And then the trust rises. It's that if that trust is there, if the relationship is doing well, you're probably going to sleep closer together anyway. But it's still a nice way to, it's a barometer.
Yes.
So if you're on completely opposite sides of the bed, you might now ask yourself, is it because one of those three factors or all of those three factors? Maybe you can list them again.
Perceived stress, attachment insecurity, or ability to trust, and sleep disturbance.
Okay. Yeah, maybe those factors are out of whack, and maybe that distance apart from each other in your bed is kind of a reminder, like, hey, there's stuff we should probably talk about.
Yeah. Cuddle buddies, couples' sleep position closeness at onset is indirectly related to lower insecure attachment through lower couple perceived stress is the name of the study if you want to read up on it. Auburn University.
One last study very quickly here. We've talked about taurine before. Taurine is mostly referenced in association with energy drinks. You'll see it right on the can or the bottle or whatever. This contains taurine. It's a nutrient that if you're not getting it from an energy drink, you get it in meat or dairy products or seafoods or protein powders.
Yeah.
A lot of protein powders are packed with taurine.
It's from a bull, right? Am I right?
Linguistically, that's absolutely where it comes from.
Yeah.
But you can get this from a lot of different places. It's also synthesized internally within the human body.
Okay.
The reason we talked about this before, 2 years ago, was there was a very, very well-conducted study published in the journal Science showing that in worms, mice, and monkeys, the numbers kind of fluctuated, but up to 12% increase in healthy lifespans. I think specifically 12% was middle-aged mice, if you give them taurine supplements. This is a clear indicator based on this one study that taurine possibly also in humans, again, this was not connected on humans, could also possibly have the same effect. Now, there are counter arguments against that. The human body has real limits as we age to how much taurine it can actually uptake. That starts dropping over time. Mm-hmm. But whatever, that was a very big positive for taurine fans around the world. Yeah. Now, a new study that is kind of freaking people out because the headlines you read might have sounded like this. Common energy drink ingredient linked to increased cancer risk. Mm-hmm. Or here's just another random one. That I pulled up. This common energy drink ingredient could increase your risk for blood cancer, a new study suggests. Well, that's scary.
Does that study exist? Or what?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's not what the study says.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's why I'm here to calm everyone. I'm not getting paid by like big taurine, even though it sounds like I'm all for this. I don't take any supplements. I don't really care. It's just I don't want people to be misinformed about this either.
Okay, what's the study say?
So this was from the University of Rochester Medical Center, published in Nature, a very, very legitimate study that effectively shows that if you have an aggressive form of leukemia, that the presence or absence of taurine can kind of ramp it up a bit. That's it. That's very different from causing it. This is saying that if you have leukemia, if you have this kind of blood cancer, already that the presence or absence of one particular amino acid will change the speed at which it operates.
And they found an association between those two things looking at mice.
But again, that's very different. There was a doctor interviewed about the study and he said, look, it's a great study. It's on mice. So it's absolutely unclear what we can even say about human beings. What I would probably say as a doctor to my patients out of a super abundance of caution is that if you've had leukemia in the past and you've gone through chemotherapy or radiation or immunotherapies, whatever, and
try to avoid taurine
and it's in remission.
Yeah.
Then maybe if you can, then don't, you know, slam home these energy drinks or these supplements. Again, what we said 2 years ago on the show with regard to that first study about the 12% increase in lifespan in middle-aged mice is that, the issue here really like for society is the energy drinks, right? Taurine on its own seems to be a decent amino acid for human beings that we need anyway.
Yeah, it's not only the taurine, it's the extremely high amounts of caffeine.
And sugar.
And sugar in these drinks. Yeah. Or fake sugar, whether it's real or not.
And artificial colors and flavorings and who knows.
Probably not good for you.
Yeah, you don't need those. And whenever you have the chance, if you can swap one for a beverage like water or something not containing all those sugars and all that caffeine, that is better for you. But taurine for now, I would still say is a supplement or is a nutrient that in some animals appears to increase health span.
Yeah.
We don't really know yet for human beings if that's the same over time, but doesn't appear to be dangerous. I just want to kind of clear the air on that one. A very complex study. If you want to look it up, it's open source. You can read it. I wish you the best of luck because there's a lot of very, very complex medical and microbiological terminology in there. That study is called Taurine from Tumor Niche Drives Glycolysis to Promote Leukemogenesis, if I'm pronouncing those words correctly.
Yeah, you made a good attempt at it. And look, if you're drinking the energy drinks because you're not sleeping well, there's all kinds of different things you can do to sleep well. And if you do sleep with a partner, try to sleep face to face with that partner.
So that you pass out from a lack of oxygen.
Or spoon with them. Because that it might help your relationship. We've got a lot of great science to come. Good science. Really thorough, good science to come.
In the meantime,
if you want to write to us about the things that we've talked about already, you can. SU@DW.com.
So there is an accusation that once in a while is levied against us science journalists, and it's true. It's that we tend to simplify things to the point sometimes of oversimplification. We've taken a complex scientific study, pages of research, and boiled it down to a sentence when in fact that doesn't paint the whole picture.
It's like maybe like a double-edged sword for a journalist, right? You want to simplify as much as possible so that the person listening or reading or watching your content can understand it, but you don't want to make it too simple.
Correct. And so, with that in mind...
You don't want to dumb it down.
In that spirit, we're going to do the opposite in the next interview here.
You mean we're going to speak to an epidemiologist?
And talk about how complex it is and how difficult it is to get sort of black and white conclusions from a huge set of data. We're about to go to a guy named Marcel in Sweden.
And let's tell people what the topic is.
We're going to talk about dying.
Science Unscripted.
Hello, my name is Marcel Balin. I'm a researcher from Sweden focusing on epidemiological studies on lifestyle and health, including mortality. So I was going to talk about a recent study that we did focusing on physical fitness and mortality.
Marcel, what's the primary conclusion from your new study on physical fitness and mortality?
Well, our primary conclusion is that it seems like the standard estimates supporting the role of being physically fit in young age in relation to preventing premature death, it may be overstated or inflated.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that we might typically believe that the effect is larger than it might be in reality. We might be overestimating the effect based on standard studies that we've typically done in this field.
So if I'm understanding you, what you're saying is that people think physical fitness or cardiovascular health is going to protect you more than it actually will from dying?
Yeah, and I would not say people in general only, but also within like the scientific field, the researchers, we typically rely on a single type of study design to answer this question regarding how important it is to be physically fit in order to live longer and healthier. And it seems like the magnitude of effect might not be as large as we assume it to be typically.
And how far off are we from the truth?
Unfortunately, we cannot really like quantify just how much the effect might be overestimated by, based only on this study. But what we can say is that it seems to be relevant, at least, and like not something that should be neglected, but taken seriously as for what it is.
How exactly did you conduct this study? Where did it start? What was the starting question? And how did you find out the answer?
We started by sort of replicating what standard studies do in this field. So we looked at the, we had a large population of young men where cardiorespiratory fitness or physical fitness was measured in young age. And using nationwide registry data, we could follow them for decades. And then we split the group into, we split the population into different groups based on their fitness level. And then looked statistically what the relationship is between the amount of fitness and the risk of mortality.
And how much longer did the fit population live compared with the part of the population that wasn't as fit?
Those with the highest fitness level had, on average, around 50% lower risk of death from all causes and cardiovascular causes, and about 30% lower risk of death from cancer.
And that does not line up with previous epidemiological data from other studies from around the world. The difference isn't as big as you would have expected, or what exactly happened with this cohort?
Well, these estimates, they were pretty much aligned with previous studies, so we were not surprised by those findings per se. But in the next step of the study, we attempt to validate these findings using another method where we actually look at the relationship between fitness and an outcome where we would not expect to see a relationship. And the reason we do that is because if we still see such a relationship, it suggests that there may be other differences between these groups of more and less fit people that are actually driving these differences in mortality rates. Because if we were to attribute the lower risk of cardiovascular death to actually fitness levels, then we should not see an effect on a random outcome.
Marcel, real quick, your study looked at 1 million young men in Sweden, right? And that was because you looked at data from the Swedish Army.
Correct.
And if I understand you and your study correctly, if you have one of those guys who's really healthy cardiovascularly and another guy who's not, then most people would assume, based on epidemiological studies from around the world, that if the unhealthy guy starts working out really hard and getting in good shape, his health outcomes are probably going to improve to be the same as the already healthy guy, right? That's what a lot of people would assume.
Yeah, I'd say so, but that's also like the, sorry if I'm now interrupting you, but the problem is often with these studies that we tend to generalize these population-based estimates down to an individual level. So all of these estimates in our study, they're based on group levels. So we're comparing groups of people to other groups of people. So it's very difficult to draw conclusions based on these group estimates to say the risk for an individual. It's always comparing groups to other groups.
And if you wanted to figure out the answer to it, take our listeners or allow them into the brain of an epidemiologist or someone who works with epidemiological data, how would you solve this puzzle?
Well, the most intuitive thing would be, of course, as some people say, to run a clinical trial, like in a drug trial, because then we randomly assign people to, in this case, one group would increase their fitness levels, the other group would not. And by chance and the randomization that comes with this trial, the groups would be comparable on all other measures. But the reality is that these trials are very difficult to conduct because it's difficult to get people to increase their fitness levels and stay more fit over a long period of time. So these trials are very rare. So that means we have to rely on these observational studies when we want to understand the effect of fitness on health. But the catch is that we typically just run one type of study all the time, or most of the time. And these studies, as I've said, come with very strong assumptions. So in my head, we need to try and incorporate different methods when answering this question. Or as I like to pose it, if we just ask the question in the same way all the time, we'll always get the same answer to it. But this answer might just be as wrong. It's not until we get the same answer from a question that we've asked in many different ways or slightly different ways that we could be more sure that it's actually the true answer, if you get what I'm saying.
We've got people all around the world listening to this who might think, oh, I should just sit on the couch. It doesn't matter anyway. Is that what they should learn from your study, that cardiovascular health doesn't matter?
No, that's not how we interpret it either. I think the key message is that there may be more nuance to this relationship than what is typically communicated. It might not be so crystal clear as we tend to assume.
And that was Marcel Ballin, an epidemiological researcher, talking to us from Uppsala in Sweden.
Can we see if we understood his work? If I got the main point.
You're putting yourself on the spot. I'm absolutely down for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because then you'll see that if you understood it.
Yeah.
By listening to what I say.
Well, go for it.
He looked at a set of 1 million Swedes, male Swedes, and he wanted to determine, or he wanted to confirm based on studies done on the effects of having good cardiovascular health on longevity or on mortality, which means the risk of dying. If you have good cardiovascular health compared to if you don't, the effect has been overstated. It's not as big. The extent to which good cardiovascular health will mean that you have a lower risk of dying has been overstated. Way it should be.
Overstated is the correct answer. So we all attribute more power to that cardiovascular health than we should for that longevity. That's it. That's why it happened. Mm-hmm. Without taking into account that, of course, the person who was vascularly fit at that period of time had all sorts of other things going on in their lives that would have caused that possibly to happen, associations and correlations happen that would have caused that to happen in the first place, and that those things might be equally as powerful or somewhat as powerful in keeping their lives long than the cardiovascular aspect.
What is more important to you guys out there, that we are unscrupulous with regard to getting a study exactly right to the extent that it might be boring or hard to listen to? Is that more important to you guys? Or would you rather have us simplify things?
Wait, you said unscrupulous.
I meant scrupulous.
Okay. We can be unscrupulous and simplify, or we can be scrupulous and...
painstakingly scrupulous.
Detailed.
Should we be that, or should we be more listenable and more simple?
Well, in a world that is very complex, it's hard to toe that line well. What do you have to say? We're at su@dw.com. I like it, yeah. I like the unscrupulous. I like that stays in there.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.